Welcome to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before we get into today's topic, we want to remind you how you can enjoy Lungcast. We're over on YouTube, where you can subscribe to our channel at Lungcast to get updates on new episodes and interview segments. You can also subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also get more Lungcast episode insights and segments at both hcplive.com and lung.org. Today's episode is a return visit by Dr. Maryam Vallapour of the Cleveland Clinic, who is Director of Lung Transplant Outcomes, and as such, she works as a physician scientist taking care of patients with a large portfolio of research, studying ways to better risk stratify patients to access transplant in a timely way and maximize survival at individual and population levels. She's also the senior investigator for lung transplantation with the United States Scientific Registry of Transplant Recipients. In this role, she oversees analysis of all U.S. lung transplant data and studies effects of allocation systems on patient outcomes before and after transplant. Today, she's joined by Dr. Kenneth McCurry, a cardiothoracic surgeon and surgical director of the Lung and Heart Lung Transplant Program at the Cleveland Clinic, and also director of the Ex Vivo Lung Perfusion Program and Respiratory ECMO Program, and he occupies the Jack B. Lally Endowed Chair in Thoracic Surgery at the Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Vallapour, thank you for your return visit, and happy that you are joined by your colleague, Dr. McCurry, to discuss some current topics in the field of lung transplantation.
Thank you.
As you know, our first meeting was back in 2021, when you and your team gave us a very comprehensive look at all things related to the indications and subsequent experience of patients undergoing lung transplantation. As an aside, I would strongly encourage our listeners to go back and listen to that podcast as well as today's. Today, I wanted to cover and update a few specific topics that were touched on during that last discussion. Lung allocation has undergone two major changes in the last couple decades, first with the implementation of the lung allocation score as the primary determinant of donor lung allocation in 2005, and second, the change to the primary geographic allocation unit back in 2017. Both these modifications helped improve the allocation system. Now, the lung allocation system helped reduce waitlist mortality and improve the efficiency of donor lung allocation. And since our last discussion, there have been further modifications to the lung allocation score, and I believe your research had some bearing on this. And in my readings, terms such as composite allocation score and continuous distribution scoring powered by AI are now being used. Can you tell us how this latest modification of the lung allocation system has impacted patients seeking transplantation?
Of course. Thank you again for the invitation to join you on this podcast. As you've already stated, in 2005, the lung transplant system for organ allocation transitioned to the LAS, which allowed us to prioritize the sickest patients for access to transplant. In nearly 20 years since its implementation, not only have we collectively become better at taking care of complex patients, but we've also become better at managing donors using advanced techniques, which you will discuss with Dr. McCurry. Now we don't need to have these strict bounds for geographic distance between the candidate and donor hospitals like we did in the past. So it was in response to these new realities that came the 2017 incremental change that would allow us to slightly broaden geographic sharing of donor lungs. The composite allocation score, or the CAS system, represents kind of the next step where we're marrying these two priorities. Here, we broaden our geographic reach in direct proportion to how sick a waitlisted candidate is or how difficult it is to find an organ for them based on their biological variables. The CAS was implemented a year ago in March of 2023. A year later, we have two important trends that I think are matter most to patients and their physicians. That is, we are transplanting more candidates now, and we have less patients dying on the waiting list. And that's likely because now we are more effectively accounting for biological barriers and limited access for certain groups of patients. And we've also broadened the geographic reach of our sickest patients so they can access transplant in a timely manner.
Another thing that came up at the time of our last discussion had to do with the importance of primary graft dysfunction and rejection, chronic inflammation causing rejection. And I was wondering if Dr. McCurry could bring us up to date on any changes in how these patients are monitored or the development of chronic graft rejection testing and whether there's been improvement in management of the condition over the last several years.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Rizzo. Yeah, this is a really interesting area of research, and I think in particular, chronic rejection, and Dr. Vallapur can attest to this as well, and perhaps speak to it a little bit after I finish. But chronic rejection really remains sort of the scourge of transplantation in general. So if you look at all the organs that we transplant, they're all subject to this chronic attrition of graft loss related to chronic allograft rejection. Indeed, if you look at survival contingent on 1 year survival, the curves from that point really haven't changed much in the 25 years that I've been involved in the field. So there's this continual attrition due to CLAD, what we term CLAD, chronic lung allograft rejection, which is essentially the form of chronic rejection that we see in lung transplants. And if you look at all the organs that we transplant, the two that are most susceptible to this and have the worst long-term outcomes are the lung and the intestine. And I think many of us conjecture that perhaps it's due to the fact that both of these organs are quite complex and they're both exposed to the external environment. So they're subject to the rigors of infection and a variety of other things like that. We've known for a long time that there are a number of factors that are associated with developing CLAD. We've sort of typically classified those into immune and non-immune mediated factors, immune being obviously rejection, both T and B cell responses, non-immune being reflux and the risk of aspiration, as well as a primary graft dysfunction, which occurs essentially from ischemia, reperfusion injury around the time of the transplantation. I think increasingly there's a lot of evidence that perhaps the pathogenic mechanism that might link these together is inflammation and ongoing inflammation in the graft. And there's a lot of new data looking at the lung microbiome. In particular, and I think this is just a super interesting area of research right now, looking at the lung microbiome and changes both in the burden and in the community of organisms in the lung and how those impact outcomes. And I'm sure as your audience, you and your audience are both well aware, there's a lot of data now in non-lung transplant, both acute and chronic lung disease, where the lung microbiome changes in the lung microbiome is associated with progression in the disease and risk of mortality. And there's some early compelling data now in lung transplantation that's being investigated. So really a super interesting area of research. And at least these initial papers, it appears to be independent of these other risk factors that I've mentioned.
Yeah, you anticipated one of my later questions, but that's great. I had doing research, I'd come across an article in Cells in 2023 that talked about how the lung transplant patient survival was not as good as others, probably because of the involvement of the microbiome in the lung. And there was another article in January 2021 by Michael Combs talking about the bacterial burden of lungs used in transplantation. So I think you're right on as far as this is the area where we need to concentrate on trying to improve whether or not addressing this is going to allow for less allograft dysfunction. I wanted to go back to another, I guess, a surgical discussion. At the last podcast, the role of ex vivo lung perfusion was mentioned. And from an article from the Cleveland Clinic, I saw a discussion of this. And at your institution, it said that in 2016, only about 1% of the transplants underwent ex vivo lung perfusion, but had risen up to 25% by 2020. So I was wondering if you could update us on the use and exactly what is EVLP. And how's it used to the benefit of patients on the wait list and post-transplant survival?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. So just to step back a little bit, one of the difficulties that we still face in lung transplantation in the United States is utilization of organs. So if you look at all donors who donate an organ in the United States, unfortunately, still only about we as the lung transplant community, we still only procure lungs and utilize them for transplant from about 20%. And there's a variety of reasons for that. There certainly are some logistical and other things like that that can be improved upon from a regional standpoint. But even more than that, I think, as you well know, Dr. Rizzo, and your audience knows, the lungs are subject to injury, and this is particularly true in donors. There's the risk of a volume overload that can lead to gas exchange issues, risk of pneumonia, a variety of things like that, pulmonary contusions, and trauma victims. So some of these things do prevent some of the organs from being utilized. So and indeed, still, unfortunately, in the United States, we have a good number of patients that die every year on the wait list waiting for a lung transplant. So EVLP, ex vivo lung perfusion, is a technique whereby lungs can be, I'll talk primarily about what I would term the stationary platform. So lungs are taken out of the body, out of the donor, transported back to the, typically back to the accepting program's hospital or perhaps to a third party. There's one company out there who I can mention later, who's doing this on a fee-for-service basis as well. And then the lungs are essentially hooked to a machine, and a solution that's very high in oncotic pressure is then perfused through the lungs. So in general, we do this only for lungs that we think are marginal for some reason. So either edematous, perhaps infection, although usually not, or lungs that we're just not sure whether they're going to work well if we transplant them or not. So we see it as a way of being able to assess the lungs over a longer period of time, and to potentially to do things to make the lungs better. So we keep the lungs on the device for up to about 3 to 4 hours. We've developed here now, we've been doing this at our institution for about 8 years, as you alluded to, beginning back in about 2016. Our volume has grown quite significantly. We've done a lot of research around this area, particularly looking at diagnostics and ways of evaluating the lungs while they're on EVLP to determine whether they're suitable for transplantation or not. And we've also done some work looking at therapeutics, so pharmacologic agents or other sorts of strategies that we might utilize to make those marginal lungs better and to make them transplantable. So currently, on a year-to-year basis, that's actually about anywhere from about 25 to about 35% of our volume. So we do about 30 to 35 lung transplants a year after EVLP. And again, these are essentially all lungs that we thought were marginal or not directly transplantable. So it has a significant impact on our transplant volume and our ability to offer this treatment to more patients. And as a result, we average about 120 to 130, 135 lung transplants a year at the clinic here over the last 4 or 5 years.
Is the availability of ELVP limited across the different centers across the country, or most centers trying to use it?
Yeah, so as you might imagine from what I just described, it's a little bit complex. It requires that you do it frequently. So, it's not like a fire drill every time it's being done. And that has been the problem that a few institutions around the country that have tried to do it, they do it so infrequently that when they do try to do it, it's very difficult. So a couple of things. So as a result of that, there are a limited number of lung transplant programs where this device that I mentioned, the stationary device, so it's actually at your hospital.
Right.
There are a limited number of places in the country where that currently is deployed because of the necessity for people, time, money, those sorts of things.
Expertise, right.
But expertise, knowledge. But as a result of that, there is one company, if I can mention the name, the company is called United, excuse me, Lung Bioengineering. They're a subsidiary of United Therapeutics. So their model is to centralize it. So they have a facility initially in Silver Springs, Maryland. The idea is that lungs from different transplant programs would be sent there, would undergo EBLP. So they would be high volume, experienced, well-trained people doing it frequently. And then if those lungs are suitable for transplant, then those lungs would then be sent back to the transplant program to be transplanted. That's currently, so they do it two ways. They do it currently in collaboration with the company that makes the one FDA approved device in the United States. That company is called XVIVO. The device is called the XPS device. That's the device that we have here at the clinic. But they also have their own device, which is essentially a homemade device. And that homemade device is currently undergoing a clinical trial with the NIH. We've participated in both the phase one and the phase two trial. And phase two trial was just completed. And the data is being collated for presentation to the FDA for approval.
So when we first chatted with Dr. Valapour in 2021, the transplant of patients with respiratory failure due to severe COVID was just starting to make news. I believe it's become a bit more commonplace for post-infectious COVID patients to be candidates for lung transplantation. Has that been the experience at the Cleveland Clinic?
I will tell you that in 2021, so immediately after the pandemic, two new categories of diagnoses became prevalent in as indications for transplant. So one was COVID ARDS, and the second was interstitial lung disease due to COVID. In 2021, one out of every 10 lung transplants were performed nationally for as a result of the complications from COVID. Those numbers have come down now, but that was kind of the impact of the pandemic on the system. Also, the total number of transplants went down during the pandemic, and we are now beginning to kind of inch our way back to pre-pandemic numbers.
Yeah. I think correct me if I'm wrong, Miriam, but I think the most recent publication from the most recent national data that there are almost 400 or so transplants that have been done for COVID-related lung issues. At the clinic, you know, we struggled during the pandemic, I think, as most large lung transplant programs did on how to approach this and how to deal with this. So prior to the pandemic, essentially all lung transplant programs would decline any patient for transplant who was in acute respiratory failure from ARDS or some sort of other etiology. As we've discussed, long-term outcomes are still plagued by issues. Organ access is still difficult and plagued, and we have, you know, more need than at least current utilization is, although many of us are working on ways of increasing the supply. So we sort of saw patients who were acutely ill and very sick and ventilated as just being too risky to consider proceeding with a lung transplant. And obviously all that changed with the pandemic. And we, again, like many other lung transplant programs, I think struggled initially with how to approach this. Do we accept these patients? Do we not? If we do accept them, should we hold them to the same criteria that we hold ambulatory patients to? Ambulatory out of the hospital patients. Our hospitalized patients who are quite sick in general, our approach for a decade or more has been to try to ambulate them either on positive pressure ventilation or with ECMO support so that they're not deconditioned and those sorts of things. So our experience evolved quite significantly here at the clinic. I think the first few patients we probably persisted a bit too long in trying to get them ambulatory rather than transplanting more quickly. Once we made the decision that transplant was necessary, ultimately we did, I believe, and this is a little bit off the cuff, but I believe ultimately we did about 18 lung transplants for ARDS related COVID. In general, I think our outcomes were comparable to what's been described and what Dr. Valapour described, which is essentially equivalent to outcomes with for other forms of fibrotic lung disease, which is what the national data show. There were certainly these are complex patients, very difficult. The other scenario where a lung transplant is considered, as Dr. Valipour mentioned, is in patients who have recovered from COVID but have post-COVID fibrosis. We have clinics established to evaluate such patients and follow such patients, not only for transplant, but our pulmonologist, Dr. Valipour, and others do in general. So far, we've only done a couple of transplants under those conditions, but those have all gone quite well. But I think we, like many other large volume lung transplant programs in the United States, are certainly willing to consider these patients and offer transplantation to help them.
Do you know if there's any literature, and you kind of anticipated my next question, literature around post-COVID transplant patients developing or having had long COVID, which may impact their rehabilitation, their exercise level? Has that been something that's been studied in lungs? I could find very little in the literature about long COVID in these transplant patients.
So I will say that there is not much literature yet. So the pandemic occurred in 2020, and very quickly after that, we kind of included these diagnoses in the transplant registries to start capturing the experience. And we'll say it will probably be years before we know what the long-term outcomes of this patient population is. But at least we started capturing it within months of the onset of the pandemic.
Very good.
I will add, if you don't mind, Dr. Rizzo,
Sure.
that I think, at least on an individual program basis, we're all well aware of the impact of deconditioning, as I'm sure you and your audience are, on surgical outcomes in general, and in particular with lung transplantation. So certainly the rehab part of what you mentioned is very, very important. And we and others, work quite hard to prehab our patients. So patients who come to us already with chronic lung disease, we work hard to try to get them strong before the transplant, and then obviously at least in that acute period afterwards, work quite hard to continue through rehab. But I don't know the long-term implications of COVID there.
Great point about the need more time to find this out. Want to switch gears a little bit. Dr. Ankit Bharad at Northwestern, who made news with the post-COVID transplants back in 2020, also performed a double lung transplant in a patient with metastatic lung cancer over this past summer. Reviewed an article in Transplantation Reviews in June of 23 that talked about the current and future role of double lung transplant for bilateral lung cancer. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are with regard to that being an indication for patients receiving double lung transplantation, where we may stand right now with that as far as research and outcomes.
I think this is also super interesting, Alan, and I certainly applaud Ankit and his group for tackling this. I think we've known for a long time, going back really 20 years, that there were certain patients that we could probably transplant with a lung transplant with cancer and have them do reasonably well. And that's the disease that we used to formally call bronchoalveolar carcinoma, which I think has been rephrased more recently to adenocarcinoma in situ or minimally invasive adenocarcinoma. And those are actually in the ISHLT guidelines. So those early stage or minimally invasive or non-invasive cancers, there's a decent amount of data going back for a long time that those outcomes are quite reasonable. The difficulty has been, even in that population, in ensuring that it's still early stage disease and there's no regional nodal metastases, there's no invasion, anything along those lines. Certainly, what Dr. Bharat and his colleagues are doing, though, is pushing the boundaries there quite significantly. As you mentioned, recent transplant of a patient with metastatic disease to the lungs. I do think that he and his group are studying this, I think, under an NIH grant, And I believe, if I'm not incorrect, that there's a similar national support in Canada, maybe at the University of Toronto, looking similarly at this patient population. So it's certainly, there's precedent for this. As your audience may know, the liver transplant surgeons do liver transplants for hepatocellular carcinoma. Those patients actually get prioritized on the liver transplant list, and they do quite well within certain parameters. But certainly a lot to learn here, I think, about the histology, the impact of histology, how best to be sure that patients still have, or that patients have cancer that's limited to the lungs, and there's no evidence of regional nodal metastases or other sorts of things like that. And I know these are all things that Dr. Bharat and his colleagues are looking at. So certainly, certainly a valiant effort, and I think warranted for a patient population that is in need. But this is going to further expand the recipient pool, right? Potentially. So, what we talked a little bit about before in terms of expanding the donor pool, it will make that even more important and more relevant. And I think many of us have thought in the field that, we've been sort of restrictive in terms of candidacy for lung transplant for quite a long time. And part of that has been by necessity because we just didn't have enough lungs to go around. But
Sure.
I think as we're able to expand the donor pool, hopefully we can expand the recipient pool as well.
So, Dr. Vallapour, I wanted to address one other area that we touched a little bit on at the last meeting. As far back as 2013, NIH talked about disparities occurring in lung transplant patients, both before and after the LAS system was put in place, and concluded, and I quote, "Racial disparities in lung transplantation have decreased with the implementation of LAS as a method of organ allocation." More recently, there was a commentary from the JAMA Network published in April of last year talking about racial disparities among lung transplant survivors. And interestingly, it was a commentary, I believe, on an article that you had published in that same journal dealing with the socioeconomic position that racial and ethnic disparities in survival after lung transplant are related. Can you talk a little bit more about that and whether you think the recent changes in the LAS may impact the disparities at all, or what else do we have to do to really bring this more progress in this area?
Sure. Our paper, as you mentioned, showed that Black patients had worse survival after transplant. And those differences in survival by race persisted even after we adjusted for socioeconomic status. We used a composite measure of socioeconomic status called the ADI, or Area Deprivation Index. And that did not explain the differences we saw in post-transplant survival between the Black patients and non-Hispanic whites. So the accompanying commentary really asks a lot of important and still unanswered questions, such as, are Black patients more likely to receive kind of differential care in the same centers, or are they having to seek care at centers that the non-Hispanic whites are not going to? One of the kind of the more interesting questions that commentary asked was that might Black patients get delayed in reaching the waiting list or receiving a transplant? And is that accounting for this observed lower post-transplant survival that we demonstrated? I thought that last point was really important and something that the scientific community is grappling with. In fact, the National Academy of Sciences tried to address this recently in a study of the transplant systems with the goal of improving equity in the system. You see, the allocation systems like the CAS or the LAS that precedes it distribute organs among those who've already gained access to the system. So the CAS can't really address systemic inequities that may delay or prevent access altogether. Historically, the transplant registries have only started to capture patients after they were listed for transplant. So we missed all the information about those who were referred and never listed, or those who should have been referred but never were. So as a result of decades of research showing these inequities in access and this recent focus on this problem by the National Academy of Sciences, the Department of Health and Human Services recently asked the U.S. transplant system to start capturing patients at the time of referral rather than after listing. So at the very least, we will start under better understanding what happens from the point of referral to listing and who doesn't get on the list and potentially start studying that. We will still miss who should have been referred and never was with this approach. But our team, our research team, and other investigators are looking at that. And so stay tuned. There might be a solution to that.
Well, that's great. And that's kind of a great way to bring this to a little bit of a closure. You've had a very good response to my update for your Cleveland Clinic, as well as the national experience around lung transplantation. Is there anything you want to share as far as what you think lies ahead in the practice, both the science and practice of transplantation?
Yeah, I think this is a really, really exciting time to be involved in the field. There's a lot of interest. There's a lot of new science. There's a lot of technology that's being applied to the field. So, I started in this field in the late 1970s. At the time, we were doing about 750 lung transplants in the United States. We now do about 2,600. That's great. We're helping a lot more patients. However, there's still a ton of need, as you well know, as your audience knows. There's a lot of patients that die, that have died over the last decade of chronic lung disease. Many of them have not been considered for transplantation. We discussed a few of those particular types of patients today. So I think there's a lot of hope for a lot of interesting things to happen over the next 5 to 10 years. One is in the area of increased utilization of donors. I really think that we can significantly increase the supply of lungs that are transplantable. Indeed, I think it's possible to double the number of lung transplants that we're doing in the United States over the next 5 years. And I think that could be done through some of it through better management. I think, as Miriam has articulated, there's lots of things that's happening at the national level to hopefully improve regional use of organs, or at least lungs coming out of particular regions. Certainly, there are areas in the United States where a lot of donors' lungs are used from them, and other areas where there's not. So there's options there. The technology, the EVLP that we discussed before, I think really holds a lot of promise. We're working on ways of being able to do that longer. We can take marginal lungs, we can make them better. Even beyond that, ourselves and certainly lots of other people as well are working on ways to be able to modify or sort of personalize the organ. So to perhaps to decrease the immunogenicity of the organs so that it's a better match for a particular recipient. So to truly personalize medicine, to truly personalize that lung on the device, and therefore have better outcomes in a particular recipient, perhaps with less immunosuppressive medications, perhaps with a lower risk of CLAD. So I think this is a really exciting time. And not to mention, I think some of the technology that's coming along for lung replacement therapy, so artificial lungs that might prove fruitful over the next 5 to 10 years. So I think lots of promise to help patients with acute and chronic lung disease.
And I will add a little wonkier answer to that. And we'll say that the computation, the advances in computational medicine and just computer sciences and quantitative sciences will help us become smarter at matching donors and candidates. And ultimately, even if we're dealing with a smaller quantity of organs than we need, we will become smarter at using them, hopefully improving overall survival.
There's a lot to look forward to, it sounds like, in this field.
Thanks, Scott.
So I want to thank Dr. Vallaport and Dr. McCurry again for joining us today. And I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in again to Lungcast. As I mentioned earlier, if you're a fan of this particular topic, you should absolutely return to Dr. Vallaport's first episode with us back in April 2021, when she had other colleagues from the Cleveland Clinic with her. We also recently discussed lung cancer precision medicine last month with Dr. Jonathan Spicer. And for those interested in other intervention strategies, listen to that as well. So be sure again to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. Until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.